and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the presidential polls, where the race is narrowing following President Obama's lackluster performance in the first debate. Peter Brown, the assistant director of the Quinnipiac poll and the chief spokesman for the Florida and Ohio polls, joins us to discuss how much Mitt Romney has gained and the president has lost as the election enters its last month. Then, as the Iranian government's oil revenues shrink from international sanctions, while the regime continues to hide its nuclear program and finance the besieged Assad clan in Syria, we will look into the collapse of Iran's currency. A former advisor to the director of the National Iranian Oil Company, Dr. Sarah Vashkouri, joins us to discuss the devastating effect inflation is having on Iran's middle class and the poor who cannot afford basic food and medicine. Then finally, we will speak with Paul Quinn Judge, the director of the International Crisis Group, who have just released a devastating report on Afghanistan's future when the US and NATO pulls out. Afghanistan, the long, hard road to the 2014 transition. We will discuss the report's bleak findings and whether the Karzai government will deal with its own mismanagement and corruption to stave off a likely defeat by the Taliban. Joining us now is Peter Brown, the assistant director of the Quinnipiac University Poll Institute, where he is the chief spokesman for the Florida and Ohio polls. He has more than 30 years of experience as a political journalist and editor in Washington, D.C., New England, and Florida. Previously, he was a political reporter for United Press International. He also served as a White House correspondent and then political editor for Scripps Howard News Service in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Brown.
Good evening, Ian. Or I guess it's afternoon where you are.
Yes, it is indeed. And I hope it's not the twilight for Obama or dawn for Mitt Romney. But the lackluster performance that he gave in the debate seems to have cost the president dearly in the polls. Just going through the list here, Rasmussen's latest has Obama at 48 and Romney at 48. Pew has Obama at 45 and Romney at 49. Ipsos Reuters has Obama at 47, Romney at 45. Gallup has Obama at 50, Romney at 45, and Rasmussen has, that's an older one. But the long and the short...
Actually, the Gallup poll uses is their seven-day track.
Seven-day tracking, yeah.
If you just look at the 3 days since the debate, actually, they're dead even.
So this is obviously had an impact, hasn't it, this debate?
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that the debate was not Barack Obama's finest hour and a half.
So when will your latest poll come out?
Well, we don't talk about when we release polls.
I see.
But given what we do for a living, it's a fair assumption that we're not taking the last month off.
And your job with Quinnipiac is you're in charge of Florida and Ohio. No two states
and our other swing states, actually.
Right? But
and our national.
So and Mitt Romney's been down in your neck of the woods in Florida. He's been on a roll, right?
Well, Romney's obviously done well the last week, but here's the thing: up until today, the early polls were somewhat meaningless, but needed to be taken with a grain of salt because they were so quick. In other words, a good poll needs at least 4 or 5 days, generally, because to have a random sample, you have to keep going back to the phone numbers that are part of your sample, and sometimes people aren't home. So that what we're starting to see now, we start to see it today, I assume we'll see it in the next several days, is 4-day polls, 5-day polls, that will get a better reading on what's actually going on in the electorate. Obviously, Mr. Romney's had a good week since the debate, and since politics is the ultimate zero-sum game, what's good for Mr. Romney is bad for Mr. Obama. There have also been a whole series of early, quickie polls since the debate in several states, and they're basically all selling the same thing. Without going to whose they are, because some are Republican firms, some are Democratic firms, some are robo-polls, some are human being polls. We're seeing, Michigan, both they're a Democratic firm and an independent firm have it at Obama by 3. Before the debate, it was high single digits. Pennsylvania, an independent poll, has Obama by 2. That's down substantially from you know, high single, low double digits. In Colorado, you know, there's one poll has Obama up by one. In Virginia, you know, up by three. So the president remains, in Iowa, up by two. The president remains ahead in these state polls, but very narrowly and almost always within the margin of error. I mean, it would be, you know, unrealistic not to think that the national numbers will not filter down into the state polls if the national numbers continue as they're going, you know, strongly for Mr. Romney.
So also, Peter Brown, surely this bounce for Mitt Romney must be translating in terms of money. The president's been out here in California raising money, but my understanding is that Romney's having, the money's just pouring in. And prior to this, I think a lot of businessmen who would normally support a Republican candidate, because they're businessmen, they make a pragmatic decision, we're not going to give money to a loser. That's turned around, hasn't it?
Well, again, I don't have intimate knowledge of their fundraising efforts, but that would not be surprising. So, again, everybody in politics, everybody loves a winner.
So, tell us about the enthusiasm gap, because that's the difference between people who are likely to vote, which is really where I think there's a difference. Is the latest poll, for example, from Politico and George Washington University. Only 73% who support Obama say they are extremely likely to vote, compared to 86% who back Romney.
Right.
Likewise, 84% of Republicans say they are extremely likely to vote, compared to 76% of Democrats.
Right. Here's what's happened. All throughout the second half of 2011 and the first half of 2012, all the data indicated that Republicans were much more enthused about voting than were Democrats. And that's not surprising. It's easier to get people excited to voting against somebody they don't like than for someone they're not, you know, they may or may not like. That began to change in the summer. And many of these measurements got very even in terms of enthusiasm. What's happened is the debate has opened that up again. And that the Republicans who were, you know, were motivated by a desire to beat Mr. Obama, you know, clearly have seen and think that the debate has changed the status quo. I don't think there's any doubt they're right about that. The question is how much it's changed the status quo and where we go next.
Well, you know, it's odd to think that they just had an election on Sunday in Venezuela where there was an 81% turnout. We're lucky to get 60%. So, where does these numbers indicate in terms of a national turnout? Are we still at that position where most, you know, a huge percentage of our public don't even engage in these?
Well, you know, obviously, you mentioned it earlier. The polls that matter are the polls of likely voters.
Right.
You know, generally, Republicans do better in likely voter polls than registered voter polls. That's the historical record, that they get a little bit higher turnout normally and do a little better among likely voters than they do among registered voters. That's especially true in off-year elections, but even in presidential. You see that today in the Pew stuff. Pew has the two candidates even among registered voters, but Romney with a 4-point lead among likely voters.
Yeah, that was the poll that I read that's just come out from October 4th to 7th.
Right, they started polling the day after the debate.
Right.
And they did it for 4 days. That's a sufficient amount of time to have a quality poll. I'm not commenting on their numbers, but what I'm trying to suggest to you is that a polls that began that started after the day after the debate and are now starting to come out, they're long enough to give you a solid reading of public opinion.
And again,
snap polls of a day or two are, you know, historically, are less accurate on that.
But again, the poll you're referring to, Peter Brown, the Pew poll, has Obama at 45 and Romney at 49. That's certainly
among likely voters.
Yeah, amongst likely voters, and that's certainly he's up four. That's the best result that he's had
in quite some time.
So obviously, debates count, right? So
clearly that one did.
So the next one, I imagine, we don't know what the performances are going to be like, but we sure as hell know a lot of people are going to be listening, right, and watching.
I mean, well, are you talking about the second presidential or the vice presidential?
The second presidential.
I think that's right. And it's worth remembering the second presidential has a different format. It has the town hall format. And that, gives people who the debate moderators have selected a chance to enter into the discussion. And there's always a wild card notion there that in those kind of debates.
But so what does this tell us about the American voting public or the one that's being polled, the public that's being polled? Are they ephemeral? Are they that capricious that just one performance on one night can overcome months and months of campaigning?
Sure, worked for Ronald Reagan, in 1980. It's worth noting that, and the Republicans have used this as a talking point, I'm not subscribing to that, but the historical record is interesting. Ronald Reagan trailed Jimmy Carter throughout the spring and summer and early fall of 1980, and they only had one debate. And Reagan was judged by the public as the winner, and he took off from there and took the lead and just built on his lead through Election Day. I'm not saying that's going to happen by any means, but that's an example of voters changing their mind based on performance. And let's go back to what happened on Wednesday night. Romney had entered the debate with voters not terribly enthusiastic about him. Not even Republicans were enthusiastic about him. But it's worth noting that one of the reasons that's the case is that the White House, and as you mentioned, I've been doing this for God, almost 40 years now. I have never seen as effective a campaign to negatively define someone as the White House and Obama campaign's effort to define Mitt Romney, starting in the early spring, that has continued to carry on through the conventions. And that made a lot of voters suspicious or unhappy with Romney. Romney was able in the debates to show a side of him that was unfiltered by the media. And apparently a lot of voters liked that better.
And the president wasn't able to make the point that he made rather lamely, that this is a different Romney from the one that had been campaigning for the last 18 months.
Politics is a zero-sum game. What's good for one side is bad for the other. And you can say that the president blew the debate, or you can say Romney did well in the debate. The effect is the same. Romney obviously has come out with, as you pointed, a surge. Now, whether that continues or not, we're not going to know. But clearly, the campaign has changed. A week ago, there were a lot of people who wanted to count Romney out. Now, you have national polls in which they're basically tied. In many of the key states, the president continues to hold very small, statistically insignificant leads. But he still has small leads in many key states. What will happen over the next week or so will be interesting, because obviously the status quo that is the case on the morning of October 16th, which is the second debate, will then be measured against what happens that night, and then you could see a movement either one way or the other. But I think very little is likely to happen in the next week unless the vice presidential debate becomes consequential. Historically, the vice presidential debates have not been very consequential.
So the bottom line here in closing, Peter Brown, is that the national polls that are very good for Romney, they could filter down to the swing states, and he could Obama could have even worse news in the states in which he's slightly ahead.
Certainly possible, or he could recover.
Uh-huh.
But the status quo has changed. Last Wednesday morning, there were a lot of people wanting to write Romney off. Nobody's writing him off today.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Peter Brown.
No problem. Have a good evening.
You too.
Or afternoon there.
Bye. Okay, bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Peter Brown, who's the Assistant Director of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute, where he's the chief spokesman for the Florida and Ohio polls. He has more than 30 years of experience as a political journalist and editor in Washington, D.C., New England, and Florida, and previously was a political reporter for United Press International. He also served as the White House correspondent and then political editor for Scripps Howard News Service in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the Iranian economy is collapsing and whether this will bring regime change.
You don't need to change. The future's odd. You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Sarah Vakhshouri, who is an independent consultant based in Washington, D.C., a native of Iran. She was an advisor to the director of the National Iranian Oil Company International and also worked for the Petro Energy Information Network, the Iranian Ministry of Petroleum. She has worked in the private energy sector in Iran and as a senior investment analyst for Pasargad Energy Development Company and as a senior consultant to Pasargad Bank and as a senior market analyst for the Oil Pension Fund Investment Company. She's the author of The Marketing and Sale of Iranian Export Crude Oil Since the Islamic Revolution, and her writing is at svbenergy.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Vakhshouri.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
So clearly there's a lot of growing economic distress in Iran itself. People have got to be feeling the squeeze, particularly the middle class and those with a little bit of money, because they're desperately trying to convert the Iranian currency, the rial, into dollars. And the exchange rates are amazing. I mean, they have every day the rial loses its value by, up to 10, 20. It's about almost half of its value now, just dropping on a daily basis. This is a real catastrophe for the Iranian middle class, is it not?
Yeah, it is. Actually, unfortunately, in the past few months, Iranian currency lost 2/3 of its value. And in the current economy, Iranian economy particularly, unfortunately, the prices of most of the goods, even if they are not imported, are highly related to the price of dollars. And any change in the exchange rate and devaluation of Iranian currency has led and will lead, if this trend goes on and on, to inflation, and it increases a lot, the inflation.
So, Dr. Sarah Vakhshouri, the area that you worked in as an advisor to the director of the National Iranian Oil Company International, which is where Iran gets its oil, where Iran gets its money from. That's the source of its national budget. Is the oil exports? They've dried up considerably, aren't they? What is Iran exporting now in terms of oil?
That's correct. Due to the Iran's exports since June of this year, due to the EU oil embargo and the complementary sanctions on Iranian central bank, and also sanctions on insurance of Iranian crude oil cargoes, has dropped significantly. And actually, it was kind of shocking that the oil consumers of Iran reduced their purchase from Iran significantly. In the past 2 months, Iranian oil export has fell to below a million barrels of oil per day, and this amount last year around this time was almost near 2.5 million a day. It is expected to grow a bit because we are entering the cold season and the demand for oil is growing, but unfortunately the sanctions they were very effective in reducing significantly Iranian export. And unfortunately now there is this kind of buyer's market formed against Iranian oil that customers like China and India, also Japan, that we were expecting to continue importing Iranian oil are negotiating for much lower prices from Iranian side. And at this point, there is no sign that Iran is going to give a significant discount to them. Therefore, Iranian export has dropped hugely.
So with this currency crisis and with the budget crisis that Iran faces, and one of the ways this government has maintained its popularity, which I believe is at an all-time low, has been through subsidies of fuel and food. They've had to cut them off. I mentioned the distress to the middle class because their life savings in the Iranian currency, the rial, are evaporating, and they're desperately trying to convert it into currencies like the dollar. The Iranian authorities have arrested money changers trying to stop that. I believe they're pouring money into the exchanges and pouring dollars into the exchanges now, aren't they, to stop the drop of the rial?
Yes, that's actually the solution that they implemented since a few days ago, that the Iranian currency devaluated hugely in the last week. Unfortunately, this is not going to be a stable solution. Iran never had a free market of foreign currency exchange. So always the foreign currency, for instance, dollar, was in the hand of government, sell it and inject it in the market and determining how much would be the value of their currency. As we see currently, the government does not have, because its currency reserves are about to finish or they're declining severely, that the government does not have enough foreign currency to inject it in the market and stabilize its foreign currency. What they have done in the last past few days was to arrest few people. They mentioned that they were causing problem in the invisible hand, what they call them, that they're causing problem in the foreign currency market and they're cause of the high dollars rate and devaluation of the currency. Also, they're injecting and giving extra currency to few money exchangers in order to stabilize and reduce the gap between dollar and their currency. However, we don't see that there is a general, this deal and trade of the currency, foreign currency, is not happening everywhere in Iran or in all the money exchangers. Only a few money exchangers have access to these government dollars, and the rest of the exchangers, although they are open, they are preventing to offer any rate to the people, and no one is really buying or selling. There are long queues behind the doors of those foreign exchange companies that they have access to the government dollars. And I suspect that if, again, the market starts as it was acting before, that all the money exchanges could sell or buy currencies, again, the prices of dollars will increase.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sarah Vakhshouri, who's an independent consultant based in Washington, D.C., a native of Iran. She was an advisor to the director of the National Iranian Oil Company International and also worked for the Petro Energy Information Network at the Iranian Ministry of Petroleum. She is the author of The Marketing and Sale of Iranian Export Crude Since the Islamic Revolution. Now, my understanding is that there's a lot of discontent in Iran. Now, obviously, the idea of a Persian Spring, which is what the Israeli press are talking about, maybe that's, you know, hopeful talk from Israelis, who, of course, are not happy with this government that wants to destroy them. We all experienced the Green Revolution, which was brutally suppressed. So there's an assumption there's an assumption that the Iranian people are still, you know, beneath the surface. They still want freedom and that they hate this government, at least a good percentage of the people. Now, we talked about how the middle class are being hurt and the poor Iranians probably less because they don't have any savings. But I keep hearing stories about how people are very upset, for example, with how much money the government is giving to the Assad regime in Syria, how much support they give to the Palestinians. And there's a growing movement inside of Iran saying, wait a minute, you know, why are you giving money away to these other countries? Why don't you take care of the Iranian people? So you're in touch with Iran. What do you hear from how the average Iranian feels about this economic crisis and the extent to which this government has this expensive foreign policy?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, the results of the sanctions are directly affecting people's daily life. Just looking at the inflation on every goods in Iran, particularly the food and the basic crucial foods that people are purchasing, week by week, prices are going up. Like this week in compared to the last week, the prices of milk or yogurt have all been raised. I'm not talking about meat or chicken that has been so high that maybe there are many people that currently could not really purchase them. Also, on the other hand, there are many other problems that they are facing. Most of the medicine import to Iran has faced a problem, and many of the important and crucial medicines that they were imported before to Iran are not there in the market anymore, or their prices have been increased a lot. Students are not receiving, the Iranian students that they are studying outside of Iran are not receiving any more official rated dollars that was always lower than the market. So people are really facing and hurting from the results of the current sanctions on Iranian government. But also, I feel they're losing their trust in the government more and more every day to find an effective solution. I think the lack of management and unfortunately, as you mentioned, the Iranian foreign policy in financially helping countries like Syria, at the moment that they don't have enough foreign currency reserves or their economy is facing a huge problem, is really going to, I mean, it has already done, and it's going to really increase the unsatisfaction and anger among the people.
So the estimates of hard currency that the Iranian regime has given to the Assad regime in Syria over 10 billion, maybe double that. What's your understanding of how much money has gone to support the keep the Assad regime afloat?
Well, I mean, I'm not in a position. I don't have any access to any data to know exactly how much. And I'm like you, just looking at the news. But I think just any kind of news like this that Iran has helped $10 billion to Assad regime is going to really increase the anger among people. I mean, now we just, like in the past few months, we had a massive earthquake in northwestern part of Iran where it's really going to be cold, the temperature in that area, and still people are living in their tents, and they still didn't have any, I mean, the government has not even yet built any temporary housing for them as you're approaching the cold season. So I think the number really does not matter here. Just the fact that Iran is facing an economic crisis and people are really suffering, seeing the government, instead of finding an efficient solution for the problem, rather they are sending the money that they have, or like in this situation, to other country like Syria to support the regime, is going to make people angry, of course. As I remember at that, when I was in Iran, every phase of South Pars, which would produce massive amounts of gas for Iran, would only cost $2 billion of investment. Now imagine if that $10 billion, not in, just in like oil industry, would be invested, that Iran now is suffering hugely from lack of investment. It would really help Iran for its economy, producing jobs, prosperity. But unfortunately, the management at this point in Iran is, I think, not as much as concerned that they should be.
So again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sara Vashkouri, who's an independent consultant based in Washington, D.C., a native of Iran. She was an advisor to the director of the National Iranian Oil Company International and also worked for the Petro Energy Information Network at the Iranian Ministry of Petroleum. She's the author of The Marketing and Sale of Iranian Export Crude Oil Since the Islamic Revolution. Now, given that all of these sanctions are based upon the fact that the Iranian government will not be honest with the International Energy, the International Atomic Energy Agency about what it's up to in terms of these underground facilities. There's an assumption on the part of the West that Iran is secretly trying to produce a nuclear weapon. There are, of course, conflicting information about that. But the sanctions are as a result of the P5 plus one. That includes on the permanent five of the United Nations Security Council, friends of Iran like Russia and China, who have joined in these sanctions. So Iran doesn't have too many friends, and a lot of people are wondering why it is, if they say they're not developing a nuclear weapon, why are they putting their country and their people through such pain? What is going on? So are these questions being asked by the Iranian people?
I'm sure this is a concern of many people. They're just seeing the sanctions as a result of the government's foreign policy. But I believe it's much more complicated. I see it much more complicated as it's always been discussed. As far as you saw, the Iranian government was really trying to put this step ahead, but unfortunately the red lines that Iran has for itself is much more different from the red lines that the EU, the P5 plus one and Israel are expecting from Iran. And also what I understand from the Iranian officials' statement, I feel that there's a friction between the decision makers in Iran, and yet there's not a consensus among them that where and how and when they should do the compromise. So I think the game is more complicated than it sounds, and I hope that things get solved and get better as soon as possible, because the result of the foreign policy Iran has on all these negotiations that are not reaching to a positive end is really hurting the Iranian people, and it's really affecting their life in a very negative way.
But if the Iranian people are upset that the government is giving money to Syria and to the Palestinians and not taking care of their own people, and on top of that, the economy is in free fall because of international sanctions, which are to do with the nuclear program, how much is the nuclear program, how much do the average Iranian understand why it is their country is going through these sanctions? Do they know? I mean, a lot of people have argued that this is a matter of national pride, that Iran, they're a proud people and they demand the right to enrich uranium. That's an argument that I find hard to follow, given the economic pain that's going on.
Well, I completely agree with you. I mean, of course, if a country is in a normal situation, normal economic situation, political situation, people could ask or could concern about having their nuclear program developed as part of their national pride. But at this point, that the Iranian nuclear program is causing lots of costs and lots of difficulty for people. I agree with you that it might not have as enough support as the government is talking. Of course, people are concerned about their daily life, at the end of the month, how much they are earning and how much they have to spend. I mean, you mentioned to the subsidies, and also people's wages have not been increased and are not increasing parallel to the inflation in Iran. So many goods and many foods are day-to-day reducing from people's table. I think people are very much at this point concerned about the economic situation in Iran and also their security, and very worried about their tomorrow, what is going to happen. But as you mentioned, to the Green Movement, if like the question is that, are people going to stand against the government, do another movement, have an uprising? It's very hard to really predict that. I mean, we saw a few days ago that people in front of the Central Bank of Iran and also the Grand Bazaar of Iran, they were protest. People were angry and they were trying to show their anger to the government. But on the other hand, the government of Iran and their security forces are highly alert, and they're very much ready to prevent any uprising or any movement that it could unstable their domestic political situation. So it's going to be very hard for people to stand or like to rise against the government. That's my understanding at this point.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Sarah Vaskuri.
Thank you so much for having me in your program.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sarah Vaskuri, who is an independent consultant based in Washington, D.C., a native of Iran. She was an advisor to the director of the National Iranian Oil Company International and also worked for the Petro Energy Information Network at the Iranian Ministry of Petroleum. She's the author of The Marketing and Sale of Iranian Export Crude Oil Since the Islamic Revolution, and her writings are available at svbenergy.com. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the International Crisis Group's report on Afghanistan that is extremely bleak.
And you know that there's a place in the sun for all that you've done. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Brussels is Paul Quinn Judge, who is the director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group, who have just issued a report on Afghanistan, the long, hard road to the 2014 transition. Previously, he was a foreign correspondent for Time magazine, and he has been visiting and covering Afghanistan since 1989. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Quinn Judge.
Thank you very much.
So this is quite a scathing report. Of course, the government in Afghanistan of Hamid Karzai have rejected it as nonsense. But essentially what you're saying here is that this is a government plagued by factionalism and corruption, and Afghanistan is far from ready to assume responsibility for security when U.S. and NATO forces withdraw in 2014. I've talked to a lot of specialists on Afghanistan, and certainly this doesn't come as a surprise to them. But the UN head is critical of your report, and predictably so is Karzai. Is there a lot of denial out there, do you think?
Yeah, I would have been very surprised and rather disturbed if President Karzai had welcomed the report. And I'd be surprised if NATO or the UN said that it made sense. However, I think there is quite a bit of denial, and I think in many ways our report is much more mainstream than some of the reactions from UN, from Kabul and elsewhere would lead one to believe today.
So the election that you in 2014, you're suggesting that under current conditions, the 2014 elections will be plagued by massive fraud, vote rigging in the south and east, where security continues to deteriorate, is all but guaranteed. That certainly is deja vu all over again. I remember talking with Ambassador Galbraith at the time of the last election, or after the last election, where he uncovered massive fraud and tried to get the United Nations to cancel the elections. But Kaiide backed Karzai, and Ambassador Galbraith was essentially hung out to dry. Again, the record is so clear. What's the explanation for why we accepted the last elections and assume, for some reason or other, that the next ones won't be any different?
Well, I don't think there is a particularly logical explanation. A logical approach from Washington and elsewhere would be to put as much pressure as possible, in the politest possible way, but very intense way, on President Karzai to ensure that there are fair elections in 2014. I think the message that needs to go to Kabul right now is that the stakes are getting higher with each passing year. In 2014, you don't just have the military withdrawal, but you have a test of the political legitimacy of the Karzai regime. Political legitimacy is as important as firepower, and if President Karzai and his supporters fail that test in 2014, it could be absolutely disastrous for the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Quinn Judge, who is the director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group, who have just issued a report on Afghanistan, the long, hard road to the 2014 transition. Now, I've spoken to a number of specialists, as I mentioned, on Afghanistan, including Chris Fair, who speaks the local languages. She's at Georgetown now, formerly was a UN political officer during that first election, as it happens. One of the stories that she keeps reminding us about is that in many ways the Karzai regime is a narco-kleptocracy, and that the tons of money that the U.S. has poured in to Afghanistan in terms of nation building, an enormous amount of it have gone into these garish poppy palaces that are being built in and around in the suburbs of Kabul, as well as the enormous amount of money from the U.S. taxpayers that's ended up in Dubai, where, again, the cronies and families of the Afghan elite are hedging their bets and building mansions. So,
yeah, well, a lot of money has been diverted, has stolen, misappropriated over the years, and it's exceedingly unfortunate that the countries that have provided that money, as well as providing a lot of military support, have not taken more clear steps to make sure that the money is either recovered or accounted for. The fundamental thing, though, is it is bad news for the Western taxpayer who's been putting money into this. But the key thing is that to survive in the future in Afghanistan, any political regime will need the legitimacy and confidence of its people. If the government goes again in 2014 and oversees elections which people perceive to be corrupt or chaotic or fixed, this could be a very serious blow for political confidence in the Kabul regime. They need this very badly. They've got to change their ways. If they don't, life could become very unpleasant for them as well as for the Afghan people.
So when we hear reports of an almost inevitable civil war and a collapse, at least I know that your report doesn't go that far, but it does warn of alarming consequences, and unless steps to ensure a stable transition begin now to prevent a precipitous slide towards state collapse, time is running out. That's a refrain that I've been hearing for some time. Every time anybody, and particularly the United States government, criticizes Karzai, he turns around and says the U.S. is not doing enough. We have just lost our 2,000th soldier due to friendly fire, I might add. NATO has lost over 1,000 dead as well. I don't know what the total bill is. You probably have a better idea than I do. But, you know, it's pretty galling for this guy to say that we're not making sufficient sacrifices for his country.
Yeah, well, President Karzai does seem to be rather low on rhetoric these days. He is more inclined to blame everybody else other than himself. What we are suggesting is that he can completely give up on the blame game and work on, first, recovering his own political prestige, secondly, ensuring his own place in Afghan political history by, for the first time since 2001, overseeing elections in his country which are patently and provably honest and fair, and which bring to power a political leadership which may just have enough confidence of the Afghan people to turn the situation around. And without that, Western money, Western guns, Western troops are going to be absolutely useless. It really does depend on the Afghan leadership at the moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Quinn Judge, who's in Brussels, where he's the director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group, who have just issued a report on Afghanistan, the long, hard road to the 2014 transition. So what is the role then, Paul Quinn Judge, of Pakistan in this? Clearly, they have had an investment, if you will, for the longest time in influencing, if not controlling, Pakistan. And they, along with Saudi Arabia, were the only supporters of the previous Taliban regime. And I think the assumption is that they will support a successive Taliban regime if that is to come to pass. It's worth noting that this peace march by the cricketer Imran Khan into the lawless region there was halted for security reasons, that even those sympathetic to the victims of drone strikes are not even able to get into that area because it's so dangerous. Yet Pakistan seems to be playing a kind of game here where they essentially protect the Haqqani network, harbor the Taliban, and presumably will work with them if they take over. Is that their long view? Because I would think that a radical regime in Afghanistan run by the Taliban would, in fact, empower and influence the Taliban in Pakistan itself, the Pakistan Taliban. So you'd think that there's...
I think in many ways you've answered the question. Pakistan feels that it has a long-term interest and a long-term concern in who runs Afghanistan. President Karzai and other Afghan political figures have been very critical for many years of Pakistan's role in supporting the Taliban. I think, however, the weaker the regime itself, the political system in Afghanistan becomes, the more likely that Pakistan is going to try to make sure that it has serious influence with the opponents of that regime, with the Taliban, that is. I don't see any way at the moment they're going to back off that. And once again, everything depends on the behavior and the comportment of the leaders of the Kabul government and their ability to move away from blaming everybody else and moving away from naming their enemies, however much sense it might make, and start really building bridges with their own people. And this is the fundamental challenge they're facing at the moment.
Well, the linchpin to all of this appears to be the police and the Afghan army. And one of the things that one of the aspects of this is these green on blue killings of where Afghan soldiers are killing their NATO and U.S. trainers, and this obviously has a devastating effect on morale, and not to mention I think the U.S. taxpayers wondering what's happening in terms of nation building there. Is there, in your report, what kind of grades do you give this army? It's called a national army, but my understanding is it's largely made up of the former members of the so-called Northern Alliance who fought and almost were defeated in the civil war by the Taliban. So is this a Northern Alliance type of army, or is it a true national army?
Well, a big concern is that the Afghan army is very large, and there are a lot of Western officials who point that out at every possible opportunity. They are not held to be capable of independent military activity to any large level that is held by their trainers, their Western trainers. There's a feeling that the army would take quite some time to get to that point. The question is whether they will have enough time to do so. The Taliban are showing themselves to be not only very determined and ruthless, but also particularly clever in a cynical way, clever political strategists, as we've seen from the attacks on NATO and U.S. trainers. But yet again, it's though the military issue is exceedingly important, no military is going to win the war on its own. It needs popular support and popular confidence. And until the leaders of the country have that, however good that military might be in the long term, they will be without the fundamental backup of a population which views them in a positive light as a defender of the country. So this is another challenge for the regime, and another one that the regime really has to face up to very, very quickly.
And does the report address the kind of surrogate nature of this this war, in the sense that we've already mentioned Pakistan's role in supporting the Taliban and the Haqqani network? And one of the reasons, I understand, that Pakistan is hedging and wants the Taliban to take over in Afghanistan is that they're paranoid about the influence of India with the Karzai government and with the former Northern Alliance. Is there any indication that a post-2014 collapse could end up as a surrogate war between India and Pakistan?
I think that would be a stretch. It's certainly not something we've looked at in this report. The report is quite long. It's about 17,000 words, but we don't go into everything. And in fact, we have tried to focus very much on 2014 and the chances for reversing the present rather disturbing slide politically and military of the Afghan government.
So is it possible then that in spite of the criticism that you're getting for your report, Paul Quinn-Judge, the new report from the International Crisis Group, Afghanistan, the Long Hard Road to the 2014 Transition, which I mentioned in the beginning, that the Karzai government have dismissed disdainfully, and the NATO Secretary General Rasmussen, he said he did not share in the ICG's negative assessment. Is it possible that your so-called negative assessment is in fact even perhaps positive? Because I've been hearing from some former CIA people who are saying that things could actually get incredibly much worse before 2014 rather than after 2014.
The next few years are going to be really tough. And this is why, though in many ways our conclusions are fairly straightforward, why we are stressing now that it's really a question of time that's running out. The government has to move fast to recover its ground, if it's going to recover its ground at all. It cannot assume that it has a number of years to regroup, rethink, and push forward. This is the point. 2014 is in many ways the decisive point, the watershed for the current Afghan government. After that, I fear, though I hope it's not the case, that some of the darker predictions that you've been citing might start to come true.
Well, there is an indication, is there not, that a lot of the NATO countries are going to pull out before 2014. Unless the Afghan police and army fill that security vacuum, I guess the dire predictions could become more real. I mean, you mentioned earlier these rather well-planned Taliban attacks, and along with the infiltration of the Afghan army, causing the green-on-blue killings of, I mean, the head of the U.S. Military there, General Allen, just the other day, said, you know, we're willing to sacrifice a lot for Afghanistan, but we're not really willing to be murdered for it. You can detect, I think, in the U.S. military, a real fatigue, if not disgust.
There's a real sign of fatigue, not only in the U.S. military, but in other Western countries which are participating in the operation. And this, again, should be a wake-up call for the Afghan regime. When this happens, there's always a danger, we've seen it in other wars, that people in the country where the war is taking place, Afghanistan in this case, will perceive the Western departure as a sign that they are giving up on the country. There have been problems in Afghanistan for many years now, and President Karzai has unfortunately not addressed these in any consistent or profound manner. He has to do it now because he just doesn't have too much time left and too many more levers to pull.
Well, just in closing, and then Paul Quinn Judge, I imagine it's fairly likely that there'll be more of these very well planned Taliban attacks. The recent one on the NATO base that destroyed hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Harrier jets and blew up the fueling depot. And today we learn of a suicide bomber killing a group of intelligence officers. It does seem that these are well-planned strikes, and I assume that they will continue, if not get more deadly.
Yeah, the Taliban have studied their history. They know full well that particularly spectacular telegenic strikes can create an enormous amount of political momentum against the war. They're still trying to find the best way of doing this. They tried it in Camp Bastion. I suspect they'll try it again. They're looking for the way to drive, finally, the message home to the West that this war is not worth fighting and that it's time for the West to pull out. They are guerrillas. They may be very local fighters, but there is a very clear strategic force and strategic plan guiding them. And so far, I see no reason why they would ever stop, why they would stop pushing this.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us from Brussels, Paul Quinn Judge. Again, I've been speaking with Paul Quinn Judge, who is the director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group, who have just issued a report on Afghanistan, the long, hard road to the 2014 transition. Previously, he was a foreign correspondent for Time magazine, and he has been visiting and covering Afghanistan since 1989. Okay, so you're still there, Paul? So
yep.
This will be up at ianmasters.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manas and Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.